are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
I see you've taken your some time out of running to talk to me.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for doing that.
I appreciate you having me.
You have a long way to go, it looks like.
Yeah, I've ran 1,800 miles since April 27th, so
1,200 left. And where did you start?
I started in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Wilmington, my goodness. Hey, do you have I got into bicycle riding.
Uh-huh.
And I did a 200-mile ride. I mean, that's okay. Child's play compared to what you're doing. I know that.
No.
But it's all relative. I'm 200 pounds, and me being on a bicycle is like a bumblebee trying to fly. It doesn't work.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, but I had somebody that was always with me, like back there. Do you have
behind you?
Yeah. Do you have some support like that?
Nobody's following me. No. My fiance is out here, and she goes to like hotels and works all day.
Yeah.
And then like if I need her, she'll pick me up at the end of the day. If not, then I'll run all the way to the hotel. But there were like a couple weeks where I ran by myself. With a pack on, 25-pound pack, and just ran from like hotel to hotel. So
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, listen, welcome to Serious Growth Podcast. The mission here usually is to try to tell the truth or a version of the truth, even if it hurts people's feelings. So don't hold back is my point.
Okay. Yeah.
But I see here you're obviously running across. Is it across America or how many miles are you running?
Yeah, I'm running from Wilmington, North Carolina to San Francisco, California for veterans. Yeah.
And I see here in your bio that you got into the military at a very young age. You said that you don't want to go too deep into the reason why, but you had a rough childhood. And
yeah.
I don't know if you want to talk about some of that roughness, but why was it so rough that you got yourself into being a Marine at 17?
Yeah, so I moved. My family moved every year, just about every 8 months growing up. My parents were just kind of trying to find the perfect place or whatever, doesn't exist. So it was mainly a financial thing. My parents would like run up bills in a certain town, and then we would move to a different town. And my stepfather was a supervisor, like maintenance technician at like apartment complexes. So yeah. There's always jobs in different states and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we would just move a lot. But then there was like a pretty large issue that happened with a family member that I probably shouldn't go into too much detail yet. But
the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
Yeah, there was just a lot of isolation from. Well, I just didn't have like that tribe that most people grow up with. You know, those friends or family members that you just see on a constant like basis.
Yeah.
And then around 11 years old, something pretty terrible happened. To where I didn't really communicate with my family at all either. So then I was just kind of completely isolated from just about everybody. And and we kept moving every 8 months. I went to four different high schools. And
that makes it tough.
And yeah. So
yeah, my parents, they split up when I was young, and I went to like a few different schools, but it was like kind of in the area, you know, it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that it was still a little bit difficult, but I mean, you know, to be constantly on the move like that, you know, that definitely there's some challenges to that for sure when you're that age.
But looking at it now, it's more of a blessing because this doesn't bother me at all running across America and staying in different hotels every night or staying on the side of the road or anything like that. Like my fiance is like super homesick. So,
it's funny, not funny necessarily, but it's interesting how certain things that you think are bad end up being good and vice versa.
Yeah.
It's really weird that way, you know?
Yeah.
And I think some of that has to do with how you end up not only perceiving it, but how you respond to that. You know,
yes.
I guess you can just, you know, I had some issues, health issues. And basically I talked about it in my book. It was like, you know, adversity either defines or destroys you. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, you don't have a choice, but when you do have that choice, if you take that where it's going to not destroy you, then real some interesting things happen. I mean, you learn about yourself in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got into the Marines at 17 years of age.
Yeah.
And did you have any idea? I mean, did you just, was it like a place that you thought I need to go and escape from all the madness that I'm at? And the Marines sounds like the best choice. Is that how that happened?
So I just, honestly, I wanted to be a Navy SEAL. So I would wake up at 4 a.m. every morning. my junior and senior year in high school, and go for like 8-10 mile runs, and then do my swimming and my push-ups and all that stuff. There's like a training program, Navy SEAL, like pre-training program. Yeah. And so I was training for that. I never even thought about the Marines once. And I don't know how they find out your phone number, but the Marine Corps has your phone number at 17. And they gave me a call on my birthday, and they were really? Like, hey, yeah. And they wanted me to come in and talk to the recruiter. And I laughed at the guy. I was like, nah, man, I'm gonna be a Navy SEAL. And he kind of laughed back, like, okay, yeah, right. And he's like, come on in and talk to me. And I went in there, man, and he was like a car salesman. Like, he had me signing papers in like 15 minutes. Like, he asked me, like, what do you want out of life? And he was like, he put these like cards in front of me, and he was like, some of them said like honor, courage, commitment, brotherhood, sense of purpose, like all this stuff. And he's like, order these, you know, from 1 to 10 or whatever, with the most important on top. And I wanted like a sense of purpose and commitment and brotherhood, because I had never been, you know, I never had that growing up. And so like, I put those on there, and he's like, so why wouldn't you go ahead and join today? And I was like, I have no reasons for you, man. Yeah. So I signed those papers like that day.
No kidding. And this was for Navy or for the Marines?
This is the Marine Corps.
Oh, Marine. Yeah. Marine Corps.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I just want to say something. I'm really pro-military. I mean, believe me, but in that instance right there that you're talking about, I almost think that's just a little bit disingenuous, because you got a 17-year-old kid who knows nothing. No offense, but nobody knows anything at 17, as far as I'm
concerned. No. Yeah.
And you got this guy over here who's got a lot of probably more age on you.
Oh, for sure.
And experience, and he knows how he's preying on you a little bit.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if they purposely go after like the poor neighborhoods and stuff like that, but yeah, I was in that neighborhood. But part of me, like, I think about that too, like what you just said, but like without that, like, I wasn't going to college. I graduated high school with a 2.2 GPA. I went to 4 schools. I went to over 20 schools growing up. Like, I didn't care about school. Like, I didn't have a household that, like, you know, made sure like my grades were doing well or anything like that. So, and I worked full time like in high school. So like, that was more important to me than work, than school. So without the Marine Corps, like, I would probably be working as a manager at like Domino's or something. So.
There you go. You know something? School is not for everybody. It really isn't.
Yeah.
You know, you'd like to think it would be, but the truth is it's not. And in this case, it really worked out. It sounds like it worked out way better for you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so, and it had to give me the discipline to be able to go to school later on, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
Was it a pretty big shock for you when you went into the Marines?
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't know. I was kind of ignorant of, like, the world and, like, in general at all. I really didn't know we were at war. Like, I knew we were at war, but I didn't really know we were at war, like, kind of thing. I knew I wanted to go to war, but I didn't really know why. I knew I wanted to fight for, like, America, but I didn't really know why we were at war or anything like that. Yeah. So it was kind of wild when we got to boot camp. And then we got to SOI, which is, like, the School of Infantry, where they teach you, like, how to be an infantryman, because that's what I was. And then, like, at the very end, they're like, okay, well, you're going to this unit. They, like, assign you to units. And they're like, oh, well, you guys are going to Afghanistan, like, tomorrow. It wasn't us. There was, like, another guy. Yeah. So but like at that moment, like when they were telling people that, because they hadn't told me where I was going yet, and they were telling other people that was kind of the moment where you're like, oh wait, like this is real. Like,
yeah, this is really real.
Yeah. Yeah. But fortunately for me, I had about a year before I had to go to Afghanistan. So we had plenty of training like in the fleet before that. So.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian power burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
So infantry, you know, again, I'm does that mean that you're boots on the ground?
Boots on the ground in combat, on combat patrols, on foot. Yeah.
You know, I don't know how. I'm just amazed at people that do that kind of work, whether policing or military. You know, yeah. I'm not a chicken, but I can never see myself doing that, John. I'm sorry. I mean, Russell, I can't see myself doing that. And for you to, and people like yourself to be willing to do that, I'm amazed. And I mean, I'm honored the fact that somebody like you would do that for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Marine Corps kind of numbs you to it, to the point where when you finally do get shot at, you don't freak out, right?
Like, you don't freak out when you get shot at the first time.
I did not freak out. There were some people, like the younger guys, because I actually, the first tour, I didn't see combat. The first tour, we went on a mule where you go on a boat and you like train other military. So we went to like Jordan and trained their military, and we went to Haiti during their earthquake in 2008 and helped them like pass out rice and stuff like that. But then like when I got to Afghanistan, I was actually in charge. So I was an infantry squad leader. So I led a squad of Marines in Afghanistan. And I mean, at that point, I had had 3 years of like just drills and drills and drills, like where you go to the desert and they just like you're pretending like you're in Afghanistan. And when you get there, that's how you're supposed to act. And the training just kicked in instantly. Like, I didn't think about it twice. But like, there were guys with me that after the very first firefight, they couldn't drink their water. They were just like shivering like this. Like, it was pretty wild. But they were like, you know, they were still 18, 19 when they went. So I was 21 at that point. So I actually took over a squad of Marines on my 21st birthday.
I saw that. Somebody else couldn't handle it, so they threw you in there.
Yeah, it was a sergeant. So in the Marines, it's kind of weird. Infantry gets promoted the slowest, but you can go to any other job essentially, and you can get promoted to sergeant within like 2 years. And so sometimes those guys get transferred back into the infantry. They go to like special force or I forget what, security force, where they go like guard the president and stuff like that. You see them in pictures. So they get promoted really fast because the president, when you're guarding the president, they want you to have like a nice little stack of, you know, their rank or whatever. It looks better, right? So then they come back to the infantry and then they're like, oh, they're sergeants. They should get put in charge, but they don't know anything about the infantry. So that's pretty much what happened. He took over. He didn't know what he was doing. I had been to squad leaders course, so I actually knew how to run a squad. And I was only a Lance Corporal, which is like an E3. So that's nothing in the Marine Corps. But an E3 in infantry knows everything pretty much. So I got meritoriously promoted to Corporal on my 21st birthday. But still, Corporals are only supposed to be team leaders. I was already a team leader. So they made me a squad leader as a Corporal. And that's supposed to be a sergeant's billet.
What's the difference between a team and squad leader?
Yeah, so a squad of Marines is broken down into 12. There's three teams and then the squad leader. So each team is four Marines. And then so they run, like a team leader runs that team, but it's under the squad. And then I run the actual squad. We lived on patrol bases in Afghanistan. So like essentially there was only like two or three squads on a base. It wasn't like the big camps where they have like AC and chow halls and stuff like that. We were living in the dirt. Like, we were actually digging into the ground, sleeping like in holes and stuff like that, like going on like really long, like 9-hour patrols and getting coppered into places. So it's a different experience.
I would imagine something like that changes you for the rest of your life.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like, cause the very first firefight, like I was the youngest squad leader and I'd never seen combat before. And I had to like lead guys that had also never seen combat before. I mean, it was wild. It was a nine hour patrol. We got ambushed like three times. like it was insane. And we were just out there doing census, where you like go house to house and just kind of take everybody's names down. That's all they want you really doing. Unless it's like super heavy. And we just moved to this area. It was crazy, man.
Do guys like, you know, if they like the ones that you're saying that they shook, did you have those guys that just, it was just too much, and that they just, even though they signed up for 4 years or whatever, they just, that wasn't the place that they needed to be. You had to get them the hell out.
Nah, man. Like, well, there were some people that left after, but like, you really can't, you don't really have a choice in the military, like in the Marines, especially like 4 years you signed up. If you like, if you break down after that, something like you break down, they can put you in H&S, which is like headquarters. So you'll do like paperwork and stuff.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen too often. Cause like I said, you're trained to such a high extent to where like you're supposed to essentially be numb when something like that happens. And those guys, like that was the first one. So they were, you know, kind of shook up.
Yeah.
But like later on they were fine and most of them were fine. The funniest thing was that we had an interpreter with us and he tried to run. So our doc, we have corpsmen with us and they're in the Navy, but they're essentially Marines. And they're out there to like, you know, save us if we're, you know, we get shot. And so the doc actually jumped on to the interpreter, got on top of him to like protect him and laid down fire. So that was pretty intense.
No kidding. Yeah.
He got an award for that. So
that's some wild stuff. I have a buddy of mine that was in the military. He told me, he says, I actually feel more calm when there's gunfire going through by my head. And I just, and I know he's not telling me a lie. I know the guy well enough.
Yeah.
He said, that's why I feel the most comfortable.
I was so like, it took me about, and it felt like minutes, but like this guy, he was a sniper and we hadn't seen any combat yet. So I was just thinking like, he was just talking, you know, and he's like, I think you guys are about to get in a firefight. And I was like, all right, whatever, man. And, cause we had been there for 4 months at this point, and we hadn't seen anything. Like there were firefights like between like the Afghani police and stuff like that. Yeah. And we went and helped, but it was nothing like directed at us because this place had already been cleared essentially. And so like, he said it was happening. I was like, I don't know. And so we're just kind of, I was very complacent. And so I'm just standing there and then like not even a minute later, machine gun, fire starts like pointed toward us and toward another part of my squad. We were split up into two teams and they started laying down fire on both of us. And like within, it felt like minutes, like where I was thinking, but like it was a split second decision. And like, it's almost like a video game. Like I was like, we couldn't go into this building because the building hadn't been cleared yet. And the building that we were at had been blown up by an IED the day before. And so we did have to deal with that, improvised explosive devices, just laid in like buildings and stuff, just waiting for you to step on. And so we couldn't go into the building. So I was like, I just yelled peel. And we had done this in training maybe like 20 times, but like, you know, you never know if you're actually going to use it, but I literally run behind this building and like, I'm the first one out. And so I jump out and get on the ground and start laying down fire. And then the next person runs behind me gets online. The next person runs behind him gets online and we all get online. And then we start bounding and moving like online, fire and move like toward the enemy. Like that's what we're trying to do as Marines. Man. Yeah. So five rounds are coming down toward us. We're running straight to them. And then we finally get online with the other team that was like, had machine gun fire like on them the whole time. Like it was the craziest thing. But like in my head, like I was not there. Like I was like, this, I'm leading a squad. Like that's it.
Yeah. You have to revert back to your training when it comes down to stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
so
it's like that. I mean, there's no comparison. I'm an athlete and I know that when I was put in certain situations, you know, at first the game was really fast, but then the more reps that I did, which is what you're talking about, the game actually slows down and you can be amazingly productive even though that chaos is all around you. It's hard to believe that, but I'm sure that you experience the same thing. That's what it sounds like, you
know? It's almost like a high too. Like your friend was saying, like, I mean, you're just in the zone. Like there's no, you can't be focused on anything else because it's life or death at that point.
I went to a gun show one time a long time ago, and I happened to be around some guys that were ex-Delta, you know, military. You know, they were in a circle, they're just talking, and one of the guys there, he said, you know, it's been 10 days since I've killed anybody. I'm getting the itch that I need to go, you know. It's like almost like that addiction. I heard him say that. I thought, oh my goodness, these guys operate a little bit differently than I do. My mindset,
that's intense.
So you're in the Marines and you're a squad leader. So tell me what happens from there. You know, where did you go from there?
Yeah, I never really saw myself leaving the Marines. After one of our firefights in Afghanistan, the XO, an officer came up to me, and And this guy didn't really like me too much. He didn't want me to get like meritoriously promoted. I was in his squad, or I was in his platoon, like the when I was younger, when I was like 19. He was like our platoon leader, and he just didn't think I'm like a shy dude. Like I'm very introverted. I grew up like by myself essentially because I was always in different schools and stuff. So like I wasn't very like I wasn't like outgoing. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it didn't really seem like I was an introverted leader. So like I could definitely like lead. But like I wasn't that outgoing, like out there, you know, and he wanted somebody to
yell.
So I think that's what he wanted. And so he came up to me after one of these firefights and he pulls me aside and he's like, look, and he's, you know, he's an officer. So he's been to college. He understands a little bit more about the world. And he essentially tells me like, hey, like, you could have just got everybody killed for no reason. Like, these are farmers out here. It's not Taliban. Like you, like, and in my head, this is blowing my mind because for the last 4 years, all I've been taught is Taliban is bad. You know, we need to go out there and like, and destroy the enemy so that these people can be at peace. And then he comes in here and says like, you just were in a 9-hour firefight for no reason. It's just farmers trying to protect their land. There's no reason to be doing any of this. Like you're just, you know, like you should have came back after the first firefight. There was no reason for you to continue. And I'm sitting here thinking like, well, we're trying to, you know, destroy the enemy. So that they're not out. Yeah. They're not out here anymore.
Yeah.
And like, and he pretty much was just like, that's not why we're here. And I was so like it messed me up so much, like in my head, where I just didn't think like any, like I was so confused, you know, like I was like, I thought that's what we were here to do. Yeah. And he's saying that we're not. So I was like, I'm going to get out. So I got out of the Marines, went to college and I took like a bunch of like sociology and psychology classes and then a public speaking course where essentially they all told me like, you can't talk like that. You can't speak like that. Like essentially how we talk in the Marines.
Yeah.
And then sociology, psychology, they're just like talking about like all the negatives about the military and like how like, you know, women don't have rights and, you know, and everything about equality and like all like, and stuff like I'd never heard before. And you know, a lot of it is true. And a lot of it is just like the teachers are kind of stuffed that down your throat and it like messed me up. So I actually gave up everything that I owned that I had gotten from the Marines. So like any money that I made, and bought anything with it. Like I gave it all away. I was like, I don't think I deserve any of this. Like, I think that what we did over there might've been wrong. Like, I'm not sure. And so like, I literally like went and I lived in a garage for 6 months and just trained people for free in local parks. Like I was pretty much I wasn't like a dirty hippie or anything. Like I was clean, but like, I literally like just trained people fitness wise for free in parks. Like that's all I did. I dropped out of school and I was just like, I can't, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like everything like the GI Bill, I was like, I don't think I write that. Like, I don't think that was right. Like it was crazy.
That's amazing that you get to that point and yet you were serving. I mean, honorably.
I knew I had to serve people. Like I never questioned that. And I thought that's why I joined the Marines. And so like when they put that in question, that wasn't actually service to, you know, mankind, yeah. You know, then I was like, well, I have to like write that. So, and to do that, I felt like, I had to do that. But then I ended up going on this, I biked from Wilmington, North Carolina to Tampa, Florida, 700 miles. It was kind of supposed to be like a finding myself journey kind of thing. Yeah. And I got down there and I hadn't seen my family in years. And so I was like going to reconcile with my family. And so I stopped and I went to my parents' house or their apartment. And they didn't have a car, you know, they could barely afford like groceries and stuff like that. Like it was crazy. And I was just like, what the heck? Like, I'm going to end up like this because I'm living in a garage and I'm not going to school. And I'm like, I don't want anything to do with this. So like, I gave them my bike. It was like a touring bike, suit, like it's nice little like touring bike. And to like sell, to like buy like a beater car or something. Cause the bike was worth like $1,000. And I flew back, to North Carolina and I got, like, I begged the school, the community college to let me back in. I begged my veteran friend who I'd gotten out of the Marine Corps to let me like to move into another apartment so I could have a room again, like so that I didn't have to live like in the garage.
Yeah.
And cause it was like a separated garage. I was like, I completely separated myself from everybody. I showed every sign of like, like veteran suicide awareness that like exists. Like I gave everything away. I distanced myself from everybody. Like I never thought about that at all. But
I'm just going to ask if you actually thought about that.
No, I never did. But like, if you look at the list of like signs, I exhibited every single one of them. It was wild. And nobody like reached out to me, which is actually like one of the big concerns I have and why I'm raising awareness for veteran suicide is because this isn't the only time this had happened to me. Like I had been depressed later on about different things, after graduating college. And the veterans that I talked to them since I've been out here, and they noticed and they didn't say anything because they didn't know how to say it. Yeah. And that is like, that's a huge disservice because that veteran, like you have no idea, like he could be struggling to the point where it's actually at that level. I was never anywhere near there because I never even considered it. But like, if it had been a different person, you know, then I mean, they could have taken their life and that could have been prevented, you know, with a conversation. So,
you know, I have a question for you because I have a personal training studio and there for a while, what I did is I offered for free veterans because I knew, or I learned that veterans had a hard time transitioning from coming from combat into civilian life.
Yeah.
And so my way of giving back was to offer the training for them because I thought, you know, it would be good for our discipline. It'd be good for different reasons. And so there's a part of going to being in the military is having this problem of people with struggling with mental issues. And do they have and is it better now? Did they have somebody that can help when you leave the military or just when you leave, they say, hey, thanks a lot for your service. See you later.
So there's like a week long, like separation class that you take and it like, there's, you're supposed to like make your resume and do all that. But like, it is the most boring thing I've ever been to in my life. And it's like a class, there's like 500, 600 people in it. And like, it's, like as a Marine, like I wasn't paying attention to anything that they were saying. They didn't, nothing seemed relevant, you know? And then I was diagnosed with PTSD. I saw a psychiatrist before I left and he was like, you need this, like, I don't even know. I think he said like four different pills that I needed for my anxiety and PTSD. And I was like, I'm not taking any of that. And he was like, why won't you take it? You know? And I was like, cause I don't want to be addicted to any of that like stuff. And he's like, well, it's not addictive. Like, you know, it's just going to get you through whatever. And I was just so against it. I was like, I'm just not going to do that. And so like, until I found, there's tons of like nonprofits that focus on like that kind of stuff. After all that trip and everything, and I came back, like a friend invited me to do yoga and I did yoga 6 days a week, every week for like 2 years. And that's like how I essentially like pushed down the PTSD. I was there like every day, like an hour and a half every single day. Like I didn't miss it, like that, and then running as well. But really the yoga was more of a focus at that. But like, as far as like making sure like, you know, that you stay like fit and well and or like, you know, anything like that, like they don't talk about any of that stuff in separation, but like, it's so focused on when you're in, you know, that the second that you stop doing that, second you stop waking up at 5 a.m. and going on these PT runs, you just go into this like funky, like, you know, depressive place because it's so ingrained in you, you know, and you need it at that point. You
makes know? No sense to me. You know, the body becomes its function. And so you adapt to the environment that you're in. I think one of the smartest things you probably did, Russell, was not get on those pills. You figured out a different way. Yeah. And you used your body and your mind. And fortunately, I think that it sounds like to me, like when you saw your family after so many years, that was kind of a wake up call and maybe a crossroad moment for you in your life. It almost sounds like.
Yeah. You know? No, it really was. Yeah.
And I think that here I am playing shrink, but I think that when you gave all your stuff away, to me, that almost sounds like in bodybuilding, we call it wiping the slate clean. In other words, there's all this information that you've learned. And, you know, sometimes it's just not the right information, but you have to be willing to wipe the slate clean so you can kind of start from a fresh pad or fresh foundation. It almost sounds like you did that, even though those tendencies that you had sounded like you were somebody's going to off yourself, for sure.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this now. You did this yoga for, you said 2 years, twice a day for 2 years? Is that what you said?
Every day, six days a week for 2 years. And so, at home, too.
Okay, so... Do you still PTSD. Am I saying that right, or is it PTSD?
Yeah, which way? PTSD. So, okay. Yeah.
You still have that, and you have to always deal with that, or what happens?
So, it depends on what doctor you talk to. Like, there's some doctors that say it's acute, like it doesn't last like your whole lifetime. There's no point in like naming it like that. But I think it's because so many veterans struggle, and people that like experience, you know, traumatic experiences, like they associate their life with that traumatic experience so much that they can't take it away because their sense of self is so established in it that you can't pull it out because that's who you are.
Yeah.
And so like for me, it wasn't just the Marines that did it. It was my childhood, right? Like that built on top of it, you know,
that's a 1-2 punch.
Yeah, so I had to like disassociate myself with that, and then also like disassociate myself from the stuff that I experienced in the Marines, and like create a new person essentially. Yeah. And so like I don't feel like I have any of those issues. Like, I mean, I definitely like have, you know, anxiety every once in a while, and I don't know, you know, if that's more just like general every day or if it's because I'm like more riled up than a normal person, but I don't think so, because like compared to an average person, I don't feel like, you know, I have anxiety like that.
I think we all have anxiety to some degree, and we have those days. You know, I think that you've done a fantastic job of reinventing yourself. There's no question about that. I mean, I can see that in the way your demeanor is and the way you're talking. So, okay. So then you, after that bike ride, then what, and I know that you're running now for veterans, and is it mainly for veterans that are committing suicide, or is it just in general? And so, how does this cause work and look, and why did you decide to run over 3,000 miles?
Yeah, so after I got back from that trip, I went back to school. I took all the classes over that I'd failed out of because I just left. Ended up getting A's in every single one of them. With the yoga, I think the yoga and meditation like just completely just changed my mindset on everything. And I actually ended up graduating with 3.9 GPA. Like I was honors, you know, and so graduated. Yeah, it was wild. And I never considered going to college ever. And then after that, like I went into clinical research. I was going to go into project management, but I hated it. You know, it was like, in our school, like there's a program, if you're biology, like you can also do clinical research and you'll essentially get, an internship. I got an internship at like a Fortune 500 company my junior year. Like I was like, you know, one of the top people in the program. And I hated every second of it. It was crazy. But it was like, I knew I would get a job and I knew I would get paid a lot as soon as I graduated. And I did. I got a great job the second I graduated, and I hated every second of it. But I had two veteran friends from the Marines that I was in charge of. One of them I was in charge of in Afghanistan, and he decided he wanted to be a doctor. So he got into Harvard Medical School. So now I'm sitting here like, oh man, like that's like success. Right. Yeah. And so then I have another friend who, after my other friend got into med school, decided he wanted to go to med school. And he actually didn't even really do that great in undergrad. But he still wanted to be a doctor. So he did like this post-bac program and got his grades up and got all the prereqs. And then he got into med school, and now I'm sitting here like, what am I doing in my life? You know, and it was that comparison thing, which you should never do, but I really didn't like what I was doing. So like to see them doing something that they loved, you know, I was like kind of really upset about that. And that's kind of where I went into like that second like depression, because I was like, what am I doing?
Right.
So I had all the prereqs. I had all the prereqs for med school already. And I was like, well, you know, that's like the level of success now. So maybe I'll go to med school. Right. And I loved helping people, you know, so I figured that would be a good alternative to what I was doing. I really didn't like pharmaceuticals. I don't like pharmaceuticals. And so I'm working for, you know, a pharmaceutical company, which is essentially what I was doing. Managing clinical trials isn't really something that's ever going to make me feel fulfilled.
Yeah.
So I left that job and got certified as an EMT, took a $12 an hour job to get hours that I could apply to med school or PA school. And then like, you know, I'd been there a year. You need about a year's worth of experience to be a PA, physician assistant. And then everything with COVID started going down. And at first, like, I was training for a marathon. And there's a pretty cool technique to train for a marathon that can reduce your hour or your marathon time by an hour in a year. And it's a heart rate training method. And you run it 180 beats per minute minus your age. for, you know, and you just never go over that heart rate ever. Mm-hmm. But you run it, you do, it's a volume training. So you run like a lot, but you only run at that heart rate. And then eventually your pace will increase, your heart rate will stay the same. So I was running for three and a half hours every morning before work. I was waking up at like 3:30, 4 in the morning, running and then going into work for 10 hours. It's crazy. Yeah. And so I was thinking a lot while I was, you know, running like that. And then everything with COVID, and I'd realized we were seeing COVID patients and we were, you know, testing patients for like the flu and stuff because we didn't have COVID tests at that point. And essentially the stuff that leads up to the risk factors of the disease are essentially all of the things that are killing our society anyway, right? Like high blood pressure, heart disease, right. Type 2 diabetes,
underlying illnesses, yeah. That are
coming. Everything that essentially, you know, you should be working on. Well, yeah. Not everybody, like there's certain people that get those and they, you know, they were healthy. Or they tried to live a healthy lifestyle or whatever, genetics. But for the most part, that's, you know, lifestyle diseases.
Yeah.
And so that was the biggest risk factor, were all these lifestyle diseases. And we were seeing patients come in that had all those, you know, and then they also had flu-like symptoms, but they tested negative for the flu. And I, you know, I started to kind of get upset. I was like, you know, if us as a society took better care of ourselves, then, you know, then all these people wouldn't even have to come in here and then put the healthcare workers at risk. Cause that's right. Why I was kind of upset, because essentially we had like all these signs on the front door. It was like, you know, if you have these signs and symptoms, don't come in, call, and then we'll like prepare for you. And these people would come in and then I would be checking them and I'd be talking to them, like talking to you, but like 5 feet away.
Yeah.
No social distancing or anything like that. And then like halfway through the conversation, they'd be like, oh, I have a cough. I had a fever, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I'm like, well, didn't you see the signs? And like, they didn't care, yeah. You know? And the reason that they were there was to get their blood pressure medicine or their type 2 diabetes medicine or whatever. And I'm just like, well, you know, not only did they not care about that, but they, you know, if we cared about each other as a society, you know, then we would take care of ourselves, because not only, you know, with everything going on with COVID, like you have to go into a healthcare provider and get your medicine, or go into a doctor or if you have COVID, you have to go to a hospital or something like that. Like you're spreading it to healthcare workers and everything. So you're putting them at risk just because your health is at risk. Yeah. And then at the same time, like our healthcare, like just the amount that we spend on healthcare in general as a society, like, I mean, it's insane.
And one of the highest in the world.
Yeah. And it's personal responsibility. And people don't like hearing that. But like you want
to, no, because they have to be accountable to themselves. That's no good.
No. And so Medicare, and I think like the big argument is like, oh, we want to give everybody healthcare. And I agree, like, yeah, let's give everybody healthcare, but let's also make everybody responsible for their health, and we'll bring down the bill in an insane amount. Like if everybody was healthy, then we could definitely afford healthcare for all, but not like the way that we're, the trajectory that we're going. Like you can't expect the world or the United States to just care for every single person if the person isn't going to care for, you know, the society in general. Yeah.
You got to be a part of the part of the process, you know.
Yeah,
as a trainer, I always tell my clients that. I said, you know, I can give you all the information that you need, but if you're not part of the process, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, like all of a sudden they're not so interested anymore.
Yeah. So I was on one of those runs, those 3-hour runs, and I was thinking about that. And then I'm sure you've heard of David Goggins.
Yeah.
So I was running and I was listening to somebody else's podcast while I was running on one of these morning runs. And they were like, if you haven't, you know, read or listened to David Goggins' book and you can't afford it, like I'll pay for it for you right now. Just call this number. And I was like, if this guy's willing to, like, you know, pay for the book, it must be super important. So I downloaded it, the audio version, while I was on this run and started listening to it. And he essentially in his book challenges you to do like that impossible task, like that you think is crazy and everybody else would think is crazy. And so by like 6 a.m., you know, this was a 4-hour run day, I think, for me. So by 6 a.m., you know, I'm running back toward the house. And I'm like, you know what? I think I'm going to run to Mount Mitchell, 500 miles, in 2 weeks and raise some money for for people that are that lost their jobs and can't pay their bills, because a bunch of people at this point had gotten furloughed from my work, and in Wilmington a ton of people had gotten furloughed, and unemployment wasn't kicking in yet. Like, it had been like a few weeks, bills were due, mortgages were due, and I had a couple of friends that couldn't pay their bill. Literally they were living paycheck to paycheck, you know. And so I was like, I'll just raise some money. And then it kind of turned into this huge thing. A friend was like, hey, maybe you should run to, you know, California. And I was like, all right. So I actually left 6 days after I decided to do it. And I decided to do it on that day that I listened to get the first like hour and a half of David Goggins' book. I told my fiance that day, I told my boss that day. And he just had to have somebody else that had been furloughed come back. So it wasn't a big deal for him. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, you could do it. And at this point I was just running to Mount Mitchell when I told him. Yeah. And so I had to go back 2 days later and be like, actually, I think I'm going to run to California. It might take a little
change in plans. Small change in plans.
Yeah. So somebody was supposed to come with me. The guy that originally had told me to go to California was supposed to come with me. And he decided, like, hey, it's a pandemic. Like, we're supposed to be social distancing. We're not supposed to be doing stuff like this. Like, I don't think I can go. And I was like, well, I have to go. He's like, well, can't we go like in January or something when this is all over? And I was like, no, man, I'm trying to raise money for people now, you know, trying to motivate people. That was another goal, was just to motivate people. Like, if they see me doing something crazy, maybe they can wake up at 6 and go for a little run before work or something. Yeah. And then, you know, better society and reduce the risk factors for COVID. And so I was like, we can social distance. I'm going to stay on the side of the highway. Like, we can just eat beans and rice. I'll put an Instant Pot in the van or something, you know? Yeah. And he freaked out and he's just like, I can't do it. So I went and I got a stroller, baby stroller, and I took off by myself, at 8 PM 6 days after I decided to do it. And I ran 61 miles in the first 24 hours. It was wild. I was sleeping on the side of the highway. I was doing polyphasic sleeping where I was sleeping, you know, for 30 minutes every 6 hours. It was crazy stuff.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I did that all the way till I got to Georgia. And then, he decided, he was going to come out because he didn't think I was being safe. And so he came out for a little while, and then he ended up in Atlanta. He's like, I can't do this, man. So he went back home, and then I hired a driver to come out through like some third party business person that I knew. Yeah. And he was like, oh, we'll have a business partner cover it at some point. And I was like, okay, cool. And so then I got a bill for like $5,000 after 2 weeks. And I was like, I thought, you know, somebody was going to cover this, and it didn't occur and like that at all. So I had to send him home. So then I was by myself again with a pack for a few states. I had a 25-pound pack on. And then finally my fiance came out when we got to Nashville. She's been with me. So she stays at the hotel. She works the whole time. Uh-huh. She works for biotech. She did the same thing that I was doing. She actually enjoys it. So she works all day, and then I run all day. And then if, you know, I can't make it to the hotel for some reason, if it's too far, then she'll pick me up and then she'll drop me back off in the morning the next day. So she's like, it's crazy. Some days she has to drive 2 hours, you know, drop me off, drive back to the hotel, work all day, and then pick me up again. Like,
well, that is a team effort. There's no question about that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So,
wow. Yeah. I was wondering how that, you know, that dynamic, how that worked out.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
What's the average that you run per day?
Yeah. So when I first started, I was running like 60 miles a day, 50 to 60 miles a day. The most I've ran in one day is 71 miles. That was on Memorial Day. I ran up Grandfather Mountain, and then I ran around Chattanooga in circles. I ran to the memorial. I was on every news station in Chattanooga for it. 71 miles in 24 hours. After Chattanooga, I kind of slowed down a little bit because I was going through the mountains. And now I'm averaging somewhere around 30. I did 36 yesterday. There was one day in Kentucky where I ran for 28 miles. I got to like the river that separates Illinois and Kentucky, and there was a ferry, and that was the only way across. I had to run 100 miles if I wanted to go across a different way. It was crazy, and the ferry was shut down because the winds were too bad. This farmer comes up to me. He's just like a farm lion. And he's like, yeah, man, I don't think they're going to open today. And I was like, and there's like this little like metal like thing that you could sit in, and it kind of blocked the wind. I was like, I guess I'm sleeping here, you know? And so I'm just sitting there for like 2 hours, and then he comes back and he's like, man, the ferry was coming over and I didn't even see it. He's like, oh, they're here to get me. and I didn't even know he was the owner of the ferry.
Oh my.
So and he lived on the other side. So he was just messing with me. So like they had to come get him regardless of the wind. And yeah. So he took me to the other side. I got to the other side and I hadn't eaten since 6 a.m. and it was like 8 p.m. or something like that. And Illinois was completely shut down due to COVID. Like this, the town that I got to was completely shut down. There wasn't anything open. So I got over there and I couldn't run anywhere else. Like it was like 10 or 11 at night. And so I didn't have like any food with me. I didn't bring any food because I thought I'd run into a gas station and I didn't the whole trip. Yeah. And so I actually didn't eat. I found a Coke machine and I had a $1 bill. I had a bunch of 20s, but I had a $1 bill, bought a Coke, and that was my dinner. I had to run 13 miles the next day just to get breakfast. Like you know that was probably the craziest day.
And that's a really good example of how motivation and discipline, what you can do when you have those two things.
Yeah, well, I needed to get food too. So.
And listen, for you to be able to do that, I would imagine there's a certain passion that you have for what you're doing. I mean, you have to have that in order to tolerate the stuff that you're going through. I was going to ask you if you were just really paying close attention as to how you were fueling your body, but you just answered the question that it's not always a perfect storm for you when you're out there, is it?
No. So a lot of the states I've run through like the part where it's like a food desert. Essentially, the only thing they have is like Dollar Generals and gas stations. Yeah. And they don't have good food there. If you want a banana, it costs like $1.25 at a gas station. Like that's not feasible, you know? Right. So actually there was about, I don't even know, like six states where essentially I was just running gas station to gas station. It was mainly the times when I was by myself because I didn't have a vehicle to get like to a restaurant or anything. Yeah. So if I ran up on a gas station, I had to eat because I didn't know when the next gas station was going to be, you know? Yeah. And so at first I tried to eat like vegetables and stuff, fruits. And there's just so much fiber in it that like I would have to take a minute to digest it. And I wasn't getting enough calories because I was burning like 10,000 calories a day.
Yeah.
So I actually just started eating ice cream. Out of nowhere. I was a vegetarian when I started, vegan when I started, and then I went like vegetarian. It's like, I'm gonna eat some ice cream, let me try this out. So there was a point where essentially I would stop at a gas station, I would get six ice cream bars, I would eat them all within like 5 minutes, and then I would just keep running. And it like, it didn't mess with my digestion. Like it was like, it seemed like a perfect fuel. Like, and that was perfect. And so I was like, oh, whatever. Like I can just run on whatever. And I think my body was just so deprived. Like it didn't matter. And ice cream just so, it digests so fast, you know? So
it's actually, believe it or not, when you eat ice cream and hopefully you were eating ice cream, they had full fat, high fat.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the best complex carbohydrates that you can actually eat. All right. Let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our product.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
A lot of people
I also read, and I don't know if this is true or not, but like milk is actually a superior hydration form. I don't know if it's 100% true, but I like read it. I was like, oh, that makes sense. Maybe I tricked my mind into thinking that. And
the most important thing is the result that you're getting, whether it's placebo or not.
Yeah.
To tell you the
truth. That was pretty wild.
Yeah, I learned that with like a baked potato, which you would think is a lot more healthy than ice cream, but a baked potato without butter is way worse for you as an energy source than ice cream with fat in it, you know? So
I've done like full on ketogenic diets before. Oh, okay. And so I know a little bit about that stuff, but and I've done fasting before. The longest I've ever gone without food is like 11, 12 days. So
I did that too. So I did for seven days. It was interesting.
Yeah. Really yeah, works. And you feel amazing. So you do. Like so yeah. Like it's on this run. Yeah, so the run where I was like 28 miles and then had to run, like I didn't feel bad. Like I don't want anybody thinking like I was like dying running the last 13 miles. Like I was fully energized. Like I was perfect. So so it really wasn't like it's a cool story and it like everybody's like, "Oh man, that's crazy." But it's like in my head I was probably perfectly fine.
As you do you do like a run and do you ever walk or is it constantly running? When you stop running, you just
so, stop. Yeah, so I didn't walk at all until I got to Illinois, and then I was like, I was by myself, and I was like, oh man. So like, I was like, I ran 30 miles one day, and I was like, I still had like 10 or 20 to go, and I was kind of tired. So I started walking a little bit, but then like I saw somebody like that saw me, and I was like, oh man, they saw me walking. So like I started running again. I really try not to walk. Every once in a while, like somebody will catch me walking. I'm like, dang it, man. Yeah. But I mean, I'm putting in, you know, at some points I was putting in close to 200 miles a week. I mean, that's running. I don't track anything that's not a run. So on my Strava, that's a running app. Yeah. You can see all the runs. If it's not on there, it's because I was walking. So I probably walked close to maybe 100 miles out of the 1800.
So you're still putting in a certain amount of miles running regardless.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like I don't, it's a run. It's just if I get, you know, tired and I'm a normal person too. You know, some days I don't want to run.
Of course. Yeah. You know, I did something one day. I got into, I decided that I wanted to walk from my house to the coast. And
oh, really?
Me walking and me doing stuff like that, just really out of my comfort zone. But I got a wild hair, you know? And so I thought, well, first do, I'm going to walk from my house to the airport, which is about 10 miles away.
Yeah.
Let me make sure that I've got that right. 8 to 10 miles away. I got to tell you something, Russell. I just walked. By the time I got my ass to that airport, my body was hurting so freaking bad. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. I was just walking. Yeah.
That's wild. Oh, yeah. Walking is actually, believe it or not, walking is worse than running. So like when I stopped to walk, my body hurts worse when I'm walking than I'm running, and my feet hurt 10 times when I walk than I run because like the pressure, because you're putting way more pressure on your feet because when you're running you're constantly in the air.
That's when you're walking, you put the full
weight of yourself on your foot, and so like I can't walk for more than like a mile, and like I have to run because
As I was walking, I'm thinking, okay, now this is ridiculous. How hard can this?
Yeah,
be? I'm walking.
Yeah. And yeah, thought, well, you also said you're 200 pounds. Yeah. I used to be I never made it to 200, but the most I was ever at was 198. I was benching like 305 back then.
It didn't help that I was that heavy, but I thought I was actually going to walk back to my house. I called somebody else and said, come get my ass. I'm not doing this anymore. And that was the last
hilarious.
Thing I walked like that. I did not walk to the coast, nor do I ever want to do that. It's hard enough to drive the damn thing. Anyway,
you gotta run.
So, as you're raising money for all this, how does that – work? Are people is there like,
so originally it was for veterans that were affected by COVID, and then pretty fast I realized that like there were a lot of veterans that are affected by COVID, but there are a lot of veterans that were struggling way before COVID, and like and now like it's even worse, and so I ran into a veteran friend. I'm not going to say his name, but I ran into him and we had dinner, and I went to his house and I saw this, he had a nice house and he had a nice, super nice like bike and a super nice like car and stuff like this. And I'm like, oh dude, this guy's made it. You know, he's doing awesome.
Yeah.
And I find out like a week later from another person that like this veteran's like, he's in foreclosure in his house. Like his bike had been, or his truck had been repoed. Like, and it was all because like his wife had cheated on him in Afghanistan. And then they had like a custody battle. And he had to spend like thousands and thousands of dollars on lawyer fees, and he didn't end up winning. And so like he went into debt for that, and then he couldn't pay his mortgage. And so, fortunately, because of COVID and everything, if you're struggling with mortgages right now, like the government will help you out, especially if it's a government backed loan. So I told him about that, and he got like a 3-month like furlough on his loan. So that was amazing for him. He got a little break. But like, I realized like if he's struggling, and I thought he was like doing well, you know, like there's so many veterans out there struggling, and we don't talk about it. Like I was telling like earlier, like when I was going through my depression, like I didn't talk about it. You know, I feel like people should have recognized it and maybe talked to me, but like, and they didn't do that. So there's a whole different dynamic there. But after that, I'd realized like, you know, there's just so many veterans struggling. And then the Mission 22, everything going on with that, like 20 veterans commit suicide every day. Like it's an epidemic. I mean, like these veterans, like they serve their country, and it's mostly, I mean, I imagine it's mostly combat veterans that like come back and they don't have like that tribe. They don't come back to a community. Nobody really respects what they did. Nobody. And even if not that, then nobody knows what they did. Yeah. And it's weird. It's a weird thing, because we're not in that tribal mentality anymore. We don't like live in tribes. So you go to war, you come back, nobody knows you went to war. So you feel like you have to tell people to get that acknowledgement. Like that's not how it was back in the day. Like if you were living in a tribe or a community, like if you went to war and you came back, everybody in the community knew like you went to war, right? Yeah. That's not the case anymore. So then like the veterans have to like feel like they have to tell people, which they don't really want to do. They just want to be, you know, somewhat acknowledged for their purpose. They don't have a sense of purpose anymore. Most of them stop working out. They don't have any kind of exercise routine, which I think just completely changes your entire mentality. And I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
So that was kind of, it switched from like a COVID thing to more of a, hey, we're raising awareness for veterans that are committing suicide. We want to reduce that, to zero, you know, and the way that we want to do that is to motivate veterans to get outside and exercise, because that's the cheapest and the easiest way. You don't have to go talk to a therapist. I mean, that would be awesome if you did, but I think the number one thing is for you to get outside and get a dopamine rush from a run, right? Yeah. Or a workout or whatever.
Yeah.
And then also, finances, you know, I left the Marine Corps with a 525, credit score. Like it was horrible. I got talked into a loan for a car that was 18% interest rate. Didn't know what interest was. I was 18 years old.
Yeah.
Guy, it's illegal actually to do that, to do that to a veteran or to a military person. And so I didn't know that, you know, so, ended up, you know, just racking up credit cards. And so I got out and I was like, I have to fix this. And it took me like 8 years. I had to pay off all that debt. I had to pay it off. I couldn't just like leave it. And then, so I used like the money I made in Afghanistan to do that. And most people would never do that, which is an issue. And then after I paid it off, I had to get one of the secure credit cards, right? I had to put $1,000 in it.
Yeah.
And I had to use it. And then a year later, I had to increase it. And finally I got a real credit card. And then finally, and every year since then, I've increased my limit. I have like over $100,000 in credit card limit, and I have like a zero balance now, and my credit is outstanding. But that took like 8 years.
Yeah.
And most veterans, especially combat veterans, don't have any kind of like financial literacy at all.
Yeah.
And so we want to both help veterans understand like how important that is, and to kind of give a little bit of a reset button. I didn't get a reset button. Luckily, you know, I went to Afghanistan and you got some tax-free money and you didn't spend it. So like I could pay off all those bills when I got back, and I just started there. But most veterans don't do that. They come back, they buy a nice car, and then, you know, they end up not being able to afford the nice car, you know, 10, like five months later, because they have a $500 car payment. They didn't realize like they couldn't really afford that, which is pretty much exactly what happened to me.
Yeah.
So both those two things, raising awareness for veterans that are, you know, depressed or anxious and are at risk for veteran suicide, and then trying to motivate them, to exercise, and then raise funds for veterans that need like a little reset, mainly on large bills like mortgages and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yes.
Well, listen, you are doing a noble cause, and I applaud you for that. And before we leave the show, do you have a website or something that you can direct our viewers to help out?
Yeah, it's just veteransforgood.org. And you can easily find me. It's Run Russell Run for the Run. Instagram, Facebook. I was on Fox News like 2 weeks ago.
Nice.
So if you type Run Russell Run in on Google, I'll come up. And Veterans for Good, we were using GoFundMe's, but GoFundMe actually takes a large portion of the donation. So we're using the Veterans for Good website now. And you can choose One more thing, we're also, my dog is running, not the whole thing, but partly. She's it's a Siberian Husky, and she's running for an organization called Dogs for Our Brave, and they take rescue animals and turn them into, rehabilitate them into service dogs for veterans.
Nice.
So she's raising money for that, and you can choose what you want your money to go to when you donate on the website, and that's one of the organizations. So if we raise $20,000 for Dogs for Our Brave, you get to name the dog that goes to the veteran. So there's a page, Run Russell Run, on Facebook, and I'll have everybody, once we raise that much money, then I'll have everybody kind of vote on what we name the dog. So that'll be pretty cool.
Fantastic, man. Listen, yeah. I as I said at the beginning of the show, I really appreciate you taking out your time. You could be down now, by now we've been into this thing an hour, you'd be like 10 miles down the road or something.
I could have been about a halfway to Boulder, which is 24 miles away. So
look, and I appreciate you coming on the show. And
no, I appreciate you, man. Yeah, I really do.
continued success. And, you know, if something comes up down the road, reach out to us, and, you know, we got something else that we can talk about. I think you have a fantastic story, and I'm really proud of you, man. So you be safe out there.
I appreciate it. I really am grateful that you love me.
Right on, man. You take care of yourself.
All right, you too.
See ya.
Bye.
Good job.
Thank you.
You got a lot to say. That's a lot of stuff. Good stuff, man.
Yeah, sorry if I was talking way too much. I don't know if I answered all your questions.
No, it's good. I'm glad that you did that. You know, there's some really interesting and fantastic people out there doing stuff, and it's always nice to. That's one of the things I like about podcasting, because I get to talk to a lot of different people from a lot of different people from a lot of different walks of life, and people are pretty fascinating. And you know, we. There's those out there, the bad apples, but there's a lot of seeing people out there. You know, it's pretty cool when you get the.
That's very true.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Off to dress for success, like you did.
Right on, baby.
All right. All right. I'll talk to you later. All right. Have a good one. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.